things I want to speak to this morning. First, this Sunday and what this Sunday represents. Obviously, it's special, and how many Christians celebrate it, that's of interest to us. I imagine all the churches in this town, perhaps all the churches around the world right now, are doing some of the same stuff this morning, and that's rare. So that's the first thing. And of course, the second thing is to look at the Bible and see, well, what actually happened? What makes this Sunday so special? So let's look at the account in the Bible. It's already been referenced several times. And finally, at the end, I want to make you a unique offer. I don't know if anybody's ever made you this offer before, but I want you to imagine that you are a city. But you don't get to pick the city. You can't choose Columbus or Los Angeles. You have to pick Jerusalem. So I'll ask you, can you imagine yourself as a city, the city of Jerusalem? And hopefully you'll understand why I would make such a request by the time I get there. When you think about all the things, though, that you might hold in your hand in heaven, either literally or symbolically, what would be on the list? Especially if you had been a martyr or had suffered in some way for Christ, what would you hold in your hands? In our day, I suppose you'd hold up a sign, wouldn't you? Say, don't forget me, don't forget about me. Or maybe you'd just extend your arms, I don't know, as a plea. Would you raise your fist would perhaps be the more likely thing if you'd been one of the sufferers. But that's not what we see in the Bible. If we look in Revelation chapter 7, we see this little glimpse. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb." Well, why would you hold a palm branch? That is not our culture or our time. As a matter of fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find a palm tree growing in London, Ohio. Palms, though, had great significance in the scriptures, in the biblical world, and not just in the Jewish world specifically, but kind of around the surrounding cultures. Palms were really important. They stood for victory, for well-being. Palms were on coins. They decorated temples. It was a symbol for victory in athletic competitions. And it could be a nationalistic symbol, an eagle, like we'd use an eagle or something. You know, represent your nation with this particular symbol, something on that order. And the Jews in particular bundled myrtle, willow, and palm branches together during their Festival of the Tabernacles. And they were carried in a procession and waved. That bundle was called a lulav. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, they would proceed from the temple down to the pool at Siloam and back, waving their lulav, their branches. And the bundle itself was thought to be full of rich symbols that were connected to the name of God. Each element of it, the myrtle, the palm, the willow, each had a specific meaning related to the name of God, but also a specific reference in Scripture. So Psalm 92 said, "The righteous bloom like a date palm. They thrive like a cedar in Lebanon." A Jewish commentary from much later, from the 13th century, said that the palm referred to the backbone, to uprightness. So you see, palms meant a lot in that world, perhaps a lot that we would miss automatically. And today is Palm Sunday, of all things. That combination of words won't appear in the scriptures unless it's in a heading that was put in there by a publisher. And actually, as I understand it, calling it Palm Sunday is not that old of a custom. It has had other names in church history, if I have my facts right, though. But it refers to a very ancient practice in the church. You know, the church picked this one up real early as a special Sunday. It refers to that time, about a week before the crucifixion, when Jesus and his disciples enter Jerusalem. And although it's called the triumphal entry, it's actually complicated and a layered story. And the triumphal entry might have the idea almost of a kind of irony. This is borrowed from the Romans, of course, in the entry of the generals back into the city after a big triumph. It was a big parade and one of the great events of your life if you were a Roman, when there was a triumphal entry back into the city. But as I said, it's layered. So often when we approach it naively in church, it's just a big crowd rejoicing to see Jesus. But then you always have that question, like, well, what happened then? What went so wrong in a week's time that the scene could shift and Jesus could be on the cross if the world was so full of adulation early on? Now, if you read the Gospels closely, you'll realize a lot was taught, a lot was said between the triumphal entry and the crucifixion. So you could get yourself in trouble in that amount of time, but still it's kind of surprising that by Friday, Jesus will end up on a cross. In fact, I think the crowd that gathers to lead Jesus into Jerusalem has mixed motives. They're a mixed crowd, and I think many of them have slightly mixed up minds. So you see, there's something for everybody here. And, you know, one of us, we probably all fit into one of those categories this morning, don't we? Mixed as the crowd may be, I think Jesus is trying to send a very clear message by what he was doing, what they should understand if only they could. Well, I'm going to back out from that just for a moment and talk about this holiday in the church. The Palm Sunday service, as I've said, is a very old one in church history. And what stands out is something we didn't do today, which is a processional. It's not the idea that you wave palms, which if you had them, you could use them, but the idea that you proceeded around waving them, a march, if you will, a processional. And everyone was to participate. It was a big citywide event, of course, back in a more unified Christendom. And of course, you'd usually wave your palm branch. Let me quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia. By the Middle Ages, the rite of the palms had acquired a distinctly dramatic form. The procession would go from one church to another, usually to one outside the city walls. I don't know how they dealt with the fact that that's sort of backwards. You know, it should start and come into the city, but they went out. The presence of Christ was symbolized in various ways. In some parts of France, a gospel book. In northern Italy, a large cross decorated with green foliage. In Germany, by an image of Christ born on the back of a wooden donkey. Could I get my first picture, Shepherd? There you go. That's in the National Museum in Zurich, Switzerland. And those are just two of the donkeys. I think they had seven or eight of them, and they represented the various wooden donkeys. They didn't represent. These were the actual ones they used in the city to lead Christ out and around. So I just got a couple of pictures and my favorite person there in between them. It's very interesting because whatever the first one was from the 8th century or something like that was a very primitive, you know, crudely carved thing. By the time you get way down the line, they're works of art. They're impressive sculptures. We could have mercy on Vicky now, if you will. Okay. I don't want to get in any more trouble than I am already in, Shepherd. 2 years ago, I was in the Mennonite Church in Amsterdam, Holland on Palm Sunday, and their service really fascinated me. The kids get together during the worship time with their parents, and they bake little sweet rolls in the shape of a rooster, and then they decorate crosses with candy and little sweet rolls shaped like roosters. And then in the middle of the worship, they burst into the room and they parade around the room. They have their own processional holding the palm posts up around as they march around. And then they sit down and proceed to eat the rolls. Could I get my next three pictures here? Here's one of them. They're very blurry. I was doing this undercover here. I didn't want to disrupt the service. So there's one of the palm posts and the rooster-shaped biscuit on it and a very cheerful little boy. That was very blurry. That was a little bit more fun up there. It looked like a rowdy group of kids waving their crosses with their rooster biscuits. One more. That one I picked because, of course, these are childhood projects, and some of the sweet rolls were more successfully shaped like roosters than others. I mean, I'm sure all the kids gave it their best, and some of the crosses were assembled a little better than others, and some of them disassembled during the procession. This led to tears, you know, the biscuit was on the floor and all that stuff. But they all sit down, they start eating the rooster. It was fun. The trouble for me was that when I asked people what it symbolized, no one seemed to know. You know, what's with the roosters? You know, and so I decided to call it St. Peter's Revenge. But I'll let you think about why I thought that. I don't think I started a new tradition in Holland. But anyway, in any event, I show those just to demonstrate. Palm Sunday is a big deal. It was a big deal. It is a big deal in most of church history. this outpouring of energy, this holiday ritual, this exuberance, this focus, surely it calls for our examination as Christians sitting here this morning. What calls that forth? What brings that out of us? How do we stand in relationship to the church of all history, the saints of all time? How does it connect us to those who stand in front of the throne with palm branches in heaven? I would think this would call for close examination by Christians. And even if I weren't a Christian sitting here this morning, I'd say, what is that about? What brings that out of a human being? We're a week out from Easter. It's a big week coming up. Maundy Thursday, we'll have our communion service here, of course, and we'll be commemorating the Last Supper. Good Friday follows. Good Friday commemorates the crucifixion, of course. Holy Saturday, as they call it. I don't know of any particular ritual that's connected to it. I think it was meant to be a time of mourning. Christ is dead at that point, right? And then, of course, the Easter Sunday, the great resurrection. Jesus is risen from the dead, and we celebrate it. All this to say, I wish you the very best holiday in all its cultural trappings. But we have to be sure as Christians that we're saying this is more than cute kids marching around the room with palm branches. It's more than chocolate and Easter eggs. It's more than friendly family times gathered around a big meal. All cultures have holidays. All religions have those. Good enough. Fair enough. But this one is meant for worship of Jesus Christ who rose from the dead. We're reenacting this story this coming week. All the Gospels have a version of the Palm Sunday story. They show a crowd, as I said, with mixed motives. Some innocent but naive worship, I think. And some, I'm fairly convinced by reading the text carefully, some cynical manipulation trying to make Jesus say something he doesn't want to say. And I think there's some flat-out misinterpretation going on in the crowd. Now, obviously, in the midst of this moment, this time and place, it's not a time for extended teaching, at least not right in the heat of the moment. I mean, how are you going to do that? It's a big, noisy crowd that's gathered. So Jesus is trying to communicate by his actions what they need to know, something they don't get that they need to get. And a big part of that is that donkey, that his triumphal entry isn't riding into Jerusalem on a war horse. He's taken the humble route of riding a donkey. This is a different kind of triumphal entry. And think of the Jews who have gathered. This time of year is the Passover. As I understand it, numbers in Jerusalem could swell dramatically. One ancient witness, Josephus, said that 2.5 million people participated during one Passover. By ancient city standards, that's enormous. That's an enormous flood of people. And even if it's something of an exaggeration, it's an exaggeration to make a point. That city was packed out. Passover to the Jew is a highlight of the year. It represents their freeing from slavery in Egypt. And so on their minds as they address this worship is the whole story of Exodus, of Joseph being sold into slavery, of whatever time passes before then they're reduced again to full slavery, to the rise of Moses and Aaron and Miriam, to the plagues, to the Passover itself, and then to the passing through the sea, freedom from slavery after almost 400 years, the forming of a people. And remember, all that's happening before Sinai, before the Jewish faith as we know will only come together, really, when we get to Sinai out in the wilderness. And Jews, you know, were commanded to commemorate that festival yearly in Jerusalem if they could get there. And that's why they were gathered there as Jesus was coming in. Some of them were come in early to go through some of the purification rituals that are there. And the occasion of Passover is marked by a special meal. You've probably heard of the Passover Seder, the special meal that Jews celebrate. As time went on, it becomes very formalized, maybe more so than it was even in Jesus' day, celebrated in the homes. Some of the rituals around that have become so important. The elimination of yeast, for example, becomes a highly ritualized thing that Jewish women will do the week before Passover to make sure all the yeast is out of the house. In Jesus' day, a lamb will be slaughtered. That lamb has to be put aside, as I understand it, 4 days ahead of time to be examined. Is this lamb suitable for sacrifice? And if it's not, it's rejected. And so all this imagery plays into it, the holiday rich with symbolism. What a week if you're a Jew. But then you realize that the Christian story is rooted deeply in that story. It's resting on top of it in its symbolism. And so we ask ourselves, even with little knowledge of their world, we have to say, do you want to be free? Do you realize you're a slave? And do you know what has enslaved you? And do you realize what will bring freedom? And here comes Jesus. I'll read the account from Luke. It's Luke 19. When he had said this, he went ahead, going up to Jerusalem. It came to pass, when he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany at the mountain called Olivet, that he sent two of his disciples, saying, go into the village opposite you, where as you enter, you will find a colt tied, on which no one has ever sat. Loose it, bring it here. And if anyone asks you, why are you loosing it? Thus you shall say to them, because the Lord has need of it. So those who were sent went their way and found it just as he had said to them. But as they were loosing the colt, the owners of it said to them, why are you loosening the colt? And they said, the Lord has need of him. Then they brought him to Jesus, and they threw their own clothes on the colt, and they set Jesus on him. As he went, many spread their clothes on the road. That colt, that little donkey, gets a lot of play in the story, right? Tells them to go do it a certain way. They go, and it turns out exactly that donkey's very important. The fact that he's riding this donkey into town. Then as he was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Rob read that before our worship, right? Some of the Pharisees called to him from the crowd, teacher, rebuke your disciples. You don't say that to Jesus. You say that about God as you're ascending into Jerusalem, if you're a Jew. And some of the Pharisees called from the crowd, teacher, rebuke your disciples. But he answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out. Now, as he drew near, he saw the city, and he wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you and close you in on every side and level you and your children within you to the ground. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not know the time of your visitation. Perhaps you noticed there's a strange omission in the Gospel of Luke that's in the other three Gospels, and that is that in Luke's version, nobody's waving a palm branch. I will ask him about this someday in heaven, I hope. I don't know why he leaves out that detail, but he puts in that other detail the others mentioned too, and that's about spreading the clothes out. I've learned something this morning new from Lyndon Miller, who said on good authority he knows that if you have a donkey, it will not walk on those clothes. It doesn't like unsure footing, so it would avoid them. So I'm not sure what kind of a scene we're creating there. I'm going to have to ponder what I found out this morning. It's to show us that when Jesus is riding, you can ride on anything, and an unridden colt can ride peacefully down clothing, or was having to get out around this. Very interesting. Interesting new content. I do know this, that it was a widespread ritual in the Roman Empire to spread out, and the same word is used for the spreading of the cloth, that in pagan rituals there were holidays in which sofas and couches were put in the street, and fine linen was put on them, and it was to welcome the gods down. Sort of like, you know, come here, sit on this couch, you know, be with us, sit on this sofa. And it's the same word about spreading this stuff out. And it spread from there, from welcoming the gods. It became also political, so that now during the triumphal entries of the generals and things like that, the fine linen was all spread out, clothing was spread out. So I think that's what they were emulating there, something that had started in pagan religion and then transferred itself to the triumphal entries of politics. They greeted generals that way. All very interesting. But I still have that question. If Jesus is so welcome, if there's all this adulation, if it's couched in all this religious praise and fuss, why in verse 47 then does he weep? It's not a moment, he's not got a big smile on his face and flashing victory signs around him. He's weeping. If you had known, even you, especially in this day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. It's an if statement, one of those sad if statements. If only. You have dozens of those in your life, don't you? Those turns in life that turn tragic. And you ask yourself, if only. If only I knew. If only I knew what would happen next. If only I knew the consequences. If only I knew then what I know now. Look, at age 63, I've got a lot of those. You know, there's a lot of stuff I wish I knew earlier on. I have a lot of if-then clauses. It's a kind of question, isn't it? Now, weeping, while everybody's singing his praise, now, he not only weeps, but he comes out with a very dire prediction about Jerusalem. And of course, it's going to come true, not right away. He will be crucified within the week. But about 40 years later, April 14th, 70 CE, AD, if you will, 70 AD, 3 days before Passover, as it turns out, the Romans will lay siege to the city, and it'll last for 4 months. The city will fall, over 1 million Jews will die, the city will be left in ruins, the blocks of the temple will not only be destroyed, but they will be pried apart to get the gold that's melted down into them, and not one stone will be left upon another. And so there in the midst of this triumphal entry, and we put quotation marks around it, say, if only they knew what made for peace. And you have to ask yourself, well, what was he referring to? What would make for their peace? Did they need an anti-war movement? A conflict of, a program of conflict resolution somehow or other. Better skills to avoid it. Better council members, that will lead to peace. The message, pretty clearly in scriptures, what they lacked or missed is found in verse 44. They did not recognize the time of their visitation. And if some in the crowd got it, apparently, the city at large missed it. Who was it? Who is this who's decided to ride into town on a donkey of all things? Who is he? What is he doing? What does he hope to accomplish? And they missed it. And we miss it too a lot of the time. Very inappropriate to look back and think, oh, I would have gotten it. Well, no, you wouldn't have. Well, I hope you would have been in that small group, but I mean, we miss it today, even today. Peace, and Jesus talks a lot about peace this week. Peace must always start somewhere, and I believe it must start inside you. And only when it starts inside you can it spread out and go anywhere else. It doesn't start inside of us. Our world is like theirs, full of violence. We turn our homes into armed camps. We watch evenings full of TV violence in which the realistic always settle everything by killing. And we're just being realistic, we say. We're just, you know, it's just the cold reality. We listen to a constant litany of threat that comes to us on social media and the radio and TV. Everything's the end of the world. Everything's bearing down on us. Everything pushes us to this place where we're just on the verge of collapse. The only thing that stands between me and utter ruin is my exercise of violence. And we say that's realistic. Are we being realistic? My humble opinion, as not your psychiatrist, is I think we're being paranoid schizophrenics. I don't think that's the way it is. But I think if you fill your ear with it, you'll start to think that way eventually. What makes for peace? Well, when I was a child, I was told the best defense is a good offense. So what do we need? Perhaps better drugs to soothe their souls. Maybe smarter politics. More education. That rings loudly in my world. How about a redistribution of wealth? maybe a good program of mindfulness meditation. I'm not ever really quite sure what that is, but apparently it leads to peace for some people, they think. What would make for our peace? Why do all human schemes to improve the world and create a peaceful world only go so far, and then they seem to collapse magnificently, spectacularly? They go down in flames sometimes. Well, I think it's because there is no peace in us, so it can't come out of us. I believe the Christians are called, in as much as it's possible for them, to lives of nonviolence, as much as it's possible, and that this includes risks and includes self-sacrifice. But we can't do that if our soul has no peace. If our soul only says, guard my money. If our only says, protect my turf. If our soul only knows, mine is mine, keep your paws off of it. If our soul only knows, I live to fulfill sensual pleasure. If my soul only knows, I'll get what can be gotten, I'll lose nothing, and then I'll get more. If our soul only knows, live now, that's my only investment. I must muscle my way to the front of the line, fight to stay there. Well then, of course, you only have peace when you achieve those goals. But someone might say, good luck with that. Because who gets to always be first in line? Who gets to never lose anything? Well, chances are you won't arrive there. And if you do arrive, you're one of the lucky half of 1% that could get there. What price would you have paid to have gotten there and to stay there? For the vast majority of us, peace won't come that way. It's very interesting to me that in this week that follows, Jesus will do a lot of public teaching, but then we know the night of the, what would be to us the night of the crucifixion, he holds up with his 12 and then 11 disciples when Judas leaves the room, and he's teaching them very intensely. Sort of his, you might say, his last teachings to them before he goes to the cross. In that room, that would be this week too, let's see what he says. This is from John 14. These things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring you to your remembrance all things that I said to you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. You have heard me say to you, I'm going away and coming back to you. If you loved me, you would rejoice because I said, I'm going to the Father, for my Father is greater than I. And now I have told you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe. I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me, but that the world may know that I love the Father, and as the Father gave me commandment, so I do. In case the disciples missed it out on the road a few days earlier, it's reiterated for them. This is what you don't want to miss. Events that are coming to pass. Events that they still couldn't quite conceive. And many then couldn't conceive and couldn't believe. They did not understand what Jesus intended to do, nor how he tried to accomplish it. They did not understand that they lived at a great turning point in all of history. They didn't understand that the changes that all human beings long for finally have an answer, a chance. Peace was possible. Peace inside. To many of them, at best, he was just another popular teacher of religions. Religion, and for many then, they concluded by the end of the week, it was an undeserved fame. He was a threat to peace, not the only hope for their peace. Well, the world then was much as it continues to be at this time. It sees Jesus, but it doesn't see Jesus. It can't recognize the time of visitation. They can hear this story, they don't understand it. The time when God incarnate came to the world, rode into the city on a donkey of all things, but then a week later was crucified. And that his death, mysterious as it is, puts us right with God, that God did what it took to make us right with him. And this is the foundation for peace. It's what they missed. the way to peace has been made open, and it's offered to you. There are many wonderful things in life. I am not an ascetic, by no means. Bring it on. Money, health, I wish you a lot of both. Success in flourishing times, okay with me. Good relationships that have no struggle, I hope it happens. But I know the only source for the peace we lack is in Christ. I don't think I'm going to be doing this passage a great disservice if I pull the meaning out to consider it as a personal issue. This happened, of course, as an event in Jerusalem in its day. That's how we interpret it first. But I look at this and say, I'm Jerusalem, and you're Jerusalem. And do I know who it is that's coming through the gates? Do I understand what is happening? Do I see the time of visitation? Do I even understand what that means? Well, it means Christ is coming in, and the story is reaching its peak. So what do you do? I don't offer sinner's prayer type invitations. They have some strengths, and they also have some glaring weaknesses. But I do ask you to consider Jesus. I believe that one can find their way through belief to a new life with peace of mind, peace of soul. In short, the experience of being born again when the Holy Spirit makes a new person. And it could be yours. And it happens through belief. So I ask you to consider that. You might know, if you don't, you're about to learn, that I have a great penchant for very short conclusions. So I always make the offer, if you've spaced out, pay attention. I've got two sentences, and they're coming at you fast, and they're my conclusion, and they're something of a loaded question. You are Jerusalem. Who is that who's coming toward you on a donkey?